morning. The shiur this morning on halachic issues in treating anxiety and depression is a loaded topic. It's a big issue. I'm going to tackle four sub-issues within it, I hope. As always, for practical issues, please consult your shul rabbi. This is only meant to give general guidance about sources. This is not meant to be psak in any way, shape, or form. The goal, though, is to learn from the sources information which is going to influence our practical approach to treatment. So I want to talk about four different subtopics. One, the halachic weight assigned to anxiety and mild depression. Basically, as we'll see in the vignette, the question of Shabbos, and are you allowed to treat that on Shabbos? Number two, how we view dangerous depression, and when I say dangerous, I mean severe suicidal ideation, that sort of stage. Third, the question of treating someone to avoid a state of severe depression, trying to medicate somebody in advance or treat in other ways somebody in advance of that. And then fourth, an interesting subtopic that I came across, the question of whether a person who is severely depressed might qualify as a shota within halacha, might qualify as irrational, and that would raise a whole series of new issues, as we'll see. I put the vignettes on the sheet there. I gave you five. This is a modified version of what I had sent out on Thursday. I thank those who took the time to look them over and actually send me feedback that's appreciated. The first one is Joshua. Joshua is a 45-year-old man, experiences racing thoughts and mania for which he has begun a course of antipsychotics. He's in the beginning of the course. He's still building up a level within his bloodstream. Is he, it should say he, sorry about that, permitted to take them on Shabbat? That's the opening case. And then you have, and you can see, you don't really need me to read out the vignettes aloud. So I'm going to move into the shiur itself. And the first issue is defining anxiety and depression. From a secular scientific perspective, we generally say, and this is just based on my own reading, feel free to update me, that anxiety refers to fear and panic in situations where most people would not feel it or would be able to cope with it. It may be sudden and circumstance specific, or it may be chronic. It may come and go in 15 minutes. It may last longer. Depression, on the other hand, it comes with feelings of hopelessness, despair, and anger. Low energy levels. A person becomes overwhelmed by day-to-day tasks, by personal relationships. Often they come together. People experience both. I saw one paper which argued that they're actually rooted in the same biological vulnerability. That a person will be susceptible to one will be susceptible to the other. I grew them together in the title because we're talking about dealing with mental health issues. And classically, within halacha, they are grouped together. The accounts that we have within Tanakh and within the Gemara, the two tend to go hand in hand. So I gave you one reference on your sheet to Shmuel Aleph and Shaul's condition. This is probably the most famous example of depression / anxiety in Tanakh, where the Navi says, "Ruach Hashem sarah me'im Shaul uviyatato ruach ra'a me'ez Hashem." That after Shaul has lost his throne, King Saul has it removed from him and given instead to the upstart David HaMelech, King David. We're told about Shaul's increasingly erratic behavior, and at one point he wants to kill David, and then at one point he doesn't, and they're friends again. David comes and plays music for him to calm him down, and here we're told that Hashem's spirit had left Shaul, and he was frightened by a ruach ra, an evil spirit from Hashem. Abarbanel on this pasuk describes what really sounds like anxiety. It's a remarkable description. If I had not needed to retype the entire thing in order to put it on, because it doesn't exist in a cut and pasteable form, I would have put it on the sheet. But it's very worth a look. He describes racing thoughts. He describes Shaul going from sadness to happiness. He talks about the use of music there in treating him. It's a striking description. Barbanelli, of course, is 15th century, but it's rooted in Tanakh. Similarly, if you take a look at source B, the classic account from the Gemara of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's Rabbi Yochanan's decline, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are sparring partners, if you will, within the Gemara. They debate constantly. And take a look at Beis, you get the story of Rabbi Yochanan's demise after Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish passes away. Nach Nafshei to Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. This is after a whole prelude about how Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, passes away. So it says that Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish died. V'haba kamitzar Rabbi Yochanan basrei tuva. Rabbi Yochanan was very upset. Amar Rabbanan, the sages said, man leza leis ve'ledaite. And the sages said, who's going to go? Calm down, Rabbi Yochanan. Nezel Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas, de mechadadin shmaizeh. Let's send Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas. He's very sharp. He can learn with Rabbi Yochanan, and that way he'll once again have the colleague, the peer, that he had in Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Azal Yasif Kameh. So he goes to sit in front of him. This Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas goes to sit before Rabbi Yochanan. Kom milsadava amar Rabbi Yochanan, amar lei tanya de messiah lach. Everything Rabbi Yochanan said, Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas says, oh, I can support that. I learned a lesson that backs that up. And he goes on to endorse what Rabbi Yochanan says. Amar, Rabbi Yochanan says, ad kibar lakisha. You think you're like bar lakisha, like Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish? Bar lakisha ki hava amina milsa, hava makshili, esen va'arba kushyasa. Whenever I said something, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish would challenge me 24 different ways. Umefarkina lai esen va'arba peruke, and then I would answer him with 24 different answers. Umemela rab chashmaisa, and that way our learning grew. Ve'ad amr tanya de messiah. You bring sources that support what I say. Utterly adan de shaper kamina. You think I don't know that what I'm saying is right? I don't need you to bring me support. I need you to tell me why I'm wrong, not why I'm correct. And Rabbi Yochanan walks around tearing his clothing and crying. V'amar, he said, Hecha at bar lakisha, hecha at bar lakisha. Where are you, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish? V'havakat savach, and he cried, Ad deshav daite mine, until his mind slipped away from him. That's the description in the Gemara. And bo rabban and rachmi alei v'noch nafshe, the rabbis prayed for him, and he passed away. Which enters a whole other realm, the question of whether we're allowed to pray for somebody to pass away, which is the explicit statement here in the Gemara. But I bring it only because it's often cited as an example of depression. The Gemara uses various terms to describe states of depression, confusion, anxiety. Source Gimel talks about someone who is in the stage of nitrafa daita. If you take a look at Source Gimel, it's talking about issues of nida and the idea that if a woman becomes a nida, she's not able to eat truma, the special tie that's given to the Kohanim. And the concern is, well, what about a woman who's incapable of figuring out for herself whether she's a nida or not, going through the proper cycle and all that? So the Mishnah says in the first line there, a chereshes. Chereshes I'm going to leave out of the discussion because it's its own discussion, how I define the state of cheresh. V'hashota, a person who is irrational. Shota we'll describe a little bit more in a bit, but it's basically someone who's irrational. V'hasuma, a blind person, therefore she's not able to determine whether she is, in fact, a nida or not. She doesn't know whether she bled. V'shenitra fadaita, or a woman who undergoes tiruf hadas. Tiruf hadas literally means a torn mind. The explanation here seems to be that she is confused, that she is in some way disturbed. So im yeshlem pikchos mitaknos osen vein ochlos petruma. So if they have women with them who they are close with, who are fully functional and competent, then those women can determine whether they are anida or not, and therefore they'll be able to eat truma. That's the Mishnah. So the Gemara asks, there seems to be a redundancy here. You mentioned in the Mishnah a shota, which is someone who is incompetent, mentally incompetent, who is irrational. And you mentioned nitrafa daita as well, someone who is of a confused mind. So the Gemara asks, Visha nitrafa daita hainu shota. That tiruf hadas is a shota. That's what the Gemara asks. And the Gemara answers, no. Shenitrafa daita machmas choli. It's talking about where there is an illness. There's some kind of an illness which causes her to be confused. Causes some level of confusion, some level of disturbance. I'm going to come back to this later on, because we need to have a better understanding of what this confusion is that we're talking about. So hold on to that for now. Another term, one that's actually very important to know, is gandripus. And that comes in the Gemara's description of what exactly a shota is. What does it mean for someone to be irrational? We've seen this a little bit in earlier shiurim, but I'm going to review it now. We saw when we talked about the issues of capacity and patient consent. Eza hu shota, source dalet. Who exactly qualifies as a shota, as someone who is irrational? Hayotze yechidi balayla, someone who goes out at night alone. Okay, wanders around alone at night. Valon beveis hakvaro, someone who sleeps in the cemetery. Vamekareya es kisuso, and someone who tears his clothing. Those are my three defining traits. Itmar, we learned. Rav Huna amar ashu kula bebas achas. Rav Huna says you have to be all at once in order to be a shota. If you demonstrate all three of these traits, Rav Yochanan amar afilu beachas mehen. Rav Yochanan says even if you just display one of them. To which the Gemara asks, "Hechi dami, what's your case here? Ida avet lehu derech shtus, if he's actually doing it in the manner of shtus, in the manner of one who is irrational, then afilu b'chadanami, then even one of these should make him a shota. Ida lo avet lehu derech shtus, and if he doesn't do it in the manner of shtus, in the manner of irrationality, he seems to have a reason for doing so. There's a thought process that goes into it. Then afilu kulu nami lo. Then even if he does all three, he's not a shota. So which is it? So the Gemara answers, la olam de ka'avad lehu derech shtus. It is where he does them in the manner of someone who is irrational, and yet there might be a reason why he's not a shota if he just does one of them. Like what? The Gemara walks us through it. V'halan beveis hakvaros emor kadesha tishra alav ruch tu muhude ka'avid. Maybe the person is sleeping in the cemetery because he has some misguided notion that he will be able to commune with evil spirits by sleeping in the cemetery, and therefore he sleeps there. So that would not make him irrational. That's what the Gemara is saying. Why doesn't that make him irrational? Your turn. Why doesn't that make him irrational? Right, there's a thought process and there's a reason. Exactly. Right, here his thought process is, he was taught how at some point he read a book that said to him, if you sleep in the cemetery, you'll gain magical powers. Now, most of us, it's true, would look at this and say, well, that's delusional, right? But if he lives within a society and within a world in which that's not an irrational thing to want and to believe that that there is such a thing as communicating with evil spirits, then someone says to him, this is the way you do it. He goes out and does it. He has a goal in mind, and this is his step-by-step plan for achieving his goal. It's wrong, but it's not inherently irrational. Someone walks around alone at night. So it's possible that he is gripped by gandripus. So we're going to see Rashi on this a little bit later on. But gandripus itself is generally defined as a form of anxiety. And the anxiety makes him go for walks alone at night. Now, pre-electric lighting, pre-street lighting at night, and pre-paved roads for that matter, that's a very dangerous thing to do, which is why I want to label him a shota. I want to label him irrational for walking around in a way that he could get hurt. However, if he's gripped by anxiety, and that's what drives him to seek to avoid the company of others and to just walk around alone away from everybody else, then that's actually called rational. He's no longer termed irrational. He's in a state such that being alone out there on the road feels better to him than being in this crowd that's around his house. Again, he has a goal, and he thinks through how he's going to achieve his goal. And then just to complete the source, Vamakareya, you know what, I'm not going to complete the source yet, we're going to come back to it later. The point that I wanted to bring out from that source right now was just the gandripus element. Gandripus is another term that Gemara uses to describe some kind of anxiety. The Yerushalmi, source number 5, talks about something called ra'ayon, which seems to be a suicidal fear that one might experience. And at this point, because it's getting further into the shiur, I'm not going to read the source now, but I brought it for you on the sheet. The source hey talks about an irrational suicidal fear. And then there's another term that the Gemara uses in Shabbos. I didn't even bring it on the sheet because I knew we'd be short on time at this point. But Kuf Mem Hamad Aleph talks about something called Yukra Deliba, heaviness of heart, which Avram Steinberg in his journal of in his Jewish Medical Encyclopedia defines as depression. Rambam Maimonides in source number 6, in source Vav, on the top of the second side, describes something called black bile, Mara Shechora, going back to the theory of the biles, and he's clearly describing depression. He writes, Shechaveinu ha'arev lefi ha'iyun ha'refu'i. It's a state in which a person wants those things that are sweet, where he has a bad appetite. He's, I mean, generally has a poor appetite for food. And so what we do is we try to awaken his appetite by bringing him foods that he desires, food that is sweet, food that is spiced. And this is now the key for us. A person who not just has lost his appetite, but he has the black bile awakened within him. Yasira b'shmias shirim umine neginos. He should remove it with songs and music. Ubetil beganos, by taking little walks in gardens, ubebinyanim noyim, or in fine buildings, ubeyeshiva in suros nos, or by sitting in an area that has fine statues, ukayotze bazeh, similar things, mimashiyachiv hanefesh, which broaden the spirit, v'yasir dagas hamara hashkara mimena, and remove from it the anxiety of black bile. So the Rambam, writing 1,000 years ago, is describing a treatment for what may be anxiety. He uses the term daga, what may be depression. And saying he should, he may lose his appetite, so you have to sweeten his appetite. He may need to hear music. He may need to go for a walk to go distract himself. He's giving you coping mechanisms, essentially. I actually heard something on the news just last week, the week before. They had a study on music increasing the brain's production of dopamine. Anyone hear that? Yeah, it was a very interesting idea. Okay, in any case, I'm bringing these now just to talk about how you have sources that go back Talmudically to describe different states of anxiety, depression, heaviness of heart. And we're going to come back to the issue of irrationality towards the end. So what is the halachic weight of anxiety and mild depression? Would he violate Shabbos, for example, for this purpose? So, we have precedent for the idea that indeed avoiding anxiety overrides Shabbos. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 7, you're talking about a yoledes, a woman who is giving birth. Tanu Rabbanan, Braisa says, Im ha'isa tzricha l'ner, chaverta madlekes la'as ha'ner. If a woman is giving birth, she's in labor, and she needs a flame, she needs a candle, so somebody else is allowed to light the candle for her, even though that's biblically prohibited on Shabbos. If she needs oil to rub on her skin, then they would anoint the skin with oil. That was a calming thing to do. It was soothing. So then her friend could go actively bring her oil. When he says biyad, by hand, it means without any shinui, not abnormally or whatever. You can bring it without an eruv. All the different laws are suspended for her. And if she can't bring it by hand, she can't get enough in her hand, then she should bring it in her hair. And the idea there was that you would actually put longer hair into the oil, and that would soak up the oil. Then when you arrive at your destination, you squeeze it out. So even though squeezing things out is another thing we don't do on Shabbos, nonetheless, she could do that. They made no suffix besara, and if that's insufficient, maybe a lubakli, then just bring a jug of it. That's the statement. Omar Mar, the Gemara now quotes, Im ha'isa tzricha l'ner chaverta madlekes la'as haner. We said that if she needs a candle, then her friend can actually light the candle for her. So the Gemara says, Pshita. That's obvious. This woman is in a dangerous situation. We don't want her to be anxious. So the Gemara says, no, you needed to mention it. Sricha, you did need to say it. Why? Bisuma, talking about a woman who is blind. Ma'u desema, I might have said, kem de lo chazis, since she can't see anyway, what good would the candle do her? I would have said, oh, sir, you're not allowed to light it for her. Kamash malana yusve miyasva daita. The answer is, it settles her mind. Sabra yikamidi chazya chaverta va'avdili. She figures that if she needs anything, her friend will be able to see what's necessary and do it for her. So the point in this Gemara is that you're allowed to light the candle for this woman solely for the sake of settling her mind, even though it's Shabbos. This has applications in other areas of law, such as the Gemara in Bava Basra that talks about a person who is dying and wants to issue some sort of will. He wants to say, give my money to so-and-so, take care of this for me. And the rule is that we uphold the person's words, even though he didn't write him down in a document, even though you lack proper witnesses and everything else, because you don't want this person in this situation to doubt that his words are going to be fulfilled. You're going to increase his anxiety. So we definitely are concerned about the issue of anxiety, but those are extreme cases, right? That's a case of a woman who's in labor. That's a case of a man or a woman who's on a deathbed. What about in general? So the Rambam does rule in Source Ches regarding the woman who is giving birth, that you would light a candle. He says, ideally, you should be Mishana. Ideally, you should do it in an abnormal way, so it's not a straightforward violation of Shabbos. But as needed, you could actually light a candle even for her. The Mishnah Berurah clarifies, this is even though she has people there who can help, and even though the candle is not necessary for them, even still we want her to be calm. So writes the Mishnah Berurah in Source Tests. So we do know that this is not just simply a statement in the Gemara, but it's a statement that's made by the Poskim, by the Rambam, by the Shulchan Aruch, by the Mishnah Berurah, that we're going to light a candle for her in order to relieve her anxiety. Interesting case comes up. The Menchas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, was asked the question about a person who had a horrible, some kind of very contagious disease, and he was going to be admitted to the hospital, and they were going to burn all of his property when he left the hospital. That was the protocol for whatever it was that he had. In the Tshuva, we're not told exactly what the situation was, but he wanted to know, can they bring him a pair of tefillin to wear in the hospital, knowing that they're going to destroy the tefillin afterwards? Destroying tefillin is a very serious crime. So are you able to give him the tefillin in the hospital? And the answer of Weiss gives is yes. It's needed in order to settle his mind. It's still a mitzvah that he's fulfilling. He's putting on the tefillin while he's in the hospital, so there's that point as well. It's not like you bring it in for nothing. But because he is going to be so upset about missing the chance to put on tefillin, and that may weaken his opportunity for recovery, we bring him the tefillin. And what we should do in terms of the people who want to burn them afterwards, he says, we should ask them, you know what, if we put them inside something, some receptacle, and bury it, will that be good enough for them? And that way try to avoid that they at least should not be burned.
Oh,
they don't have to be his tefillin. It could be a random pair of tefillin. What's the question?
Well, if you're positing that this was an infectious disease and bringing this to unique from his house at a time probably of black plague.
Well, the Menchas Yitzchak is 20th century England. I don't know what he had. I don't know what this patient had, but I don't know. That's the case, though. Okay. I don't know. You're the physicians. You tell me what they were going to be burning this for. It wasn't in the tshuva. They only asked the question. Okay. In any case, the Tzitz Eliezer deals with this as well. But again, as I said before, all these are dealing with patients who are already in a dangerous situation. Right? This is somebody whose condition may be exacerbated by feeling anxiety, and we don't want to do that. We don't want to put them in a worse situation. So it's clear to me that if I have a patient who is already ill, already in some kind of a dangerous situation, I have a requirement to relieve anxiety, even at the expense of biblical law. What about an otherwise healthy person? Someone who in general is healthy, but is experiencing some kind of anxiety, and it's Shabbos. The Shulchan Aruch records for us, it's a known principle that one is not allowed to take medicine on Shabbos in a normal situation. I say in a normal situation, meaning where the person can function normally on Shabbos. We're not supposed to take medicine because some types of medicine are made by grinding things up, cutting pills into smaller form, or grinding up materials to create the pills, and therefore, going back to Talmudic times, we have a rabbinic rule against taking medication on Shabbos. We're not talking about where it's going to save a life. That's not what we're talking about. So, yeah.
The medicine that a person might be taking anyway every day, those are permitted on Shabbos?
So the answer is not necessarily. It depends. There is a popular idea that once you start a course of medication, automatically you can continue it even on Shabbos. Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, addresses this in a tshuva. It's in Chilek Ches, Tshuva Tesvav, I believe, volume 8, number 15 of the Tzitz Eliezer. And he says it depends on what we're talking about. It depends on the type of medication. It isn't as a course of antibiotics, yes, we say absolutely continue to take it all the way through Shabbos. We don't want a person to stop taking medicine in such a way that it's going to weaken the effectiveness of the medicine overall. So that's true. But I wouldn't say carte blanche that all medicines that are being taken automatically continue through Shabbos. That isn't necessarily so.
The patient would come up if somebody was on some antipsychotic.
Yes.
Medication, are they allowed to take them on?
Correct. Correct. That's more what I'm thinking of, and I'm thinking of the case that I described in the first vignette. The patient Joshua, the first one, who is having racing thoughts and mania, he has begun a course of antipsychotics, and the question is, can he take it on Shabbos? So, one of our defining principles when it comes to taking medicine on Shabbos is brought in the Mishnah Berurah here, source Yud. The Shulchan Aruch writes that if a person has mechush be'alma, a little ache, but he can get over it and go through Shabbos and conduct himself normally, and he has a little bit of an ache, he should not take medicine for it on Shabbos. So the Mishnah Berurah says on that, source Yud, Din ka'iv le'tuva, if a person is in great pain, v'chala kol gufa, his whole body is ill, al yedei zeviyadis, o shenafa l'mishkav, or he becomes bedridden, he has to go lie down. Am she'en bo sakana, granted he's not dangerously ill, muter lasos bishvilo refuah she'en bo malacha, you are allowed to heal him in ways that don't violate Shabbos biblically. So I can violate a derabbanan, and he can take medicine. I believe that, and it's going to vary based on the person, but there are cases of anxiety which don't qualify as life-threatening. The person is not suicidal, but would force the person already to go to bed. The person would need to get away. The person would become bedridden. And on the basis of this Mishnah Berurah, it seems that one would be allowed in such a case to medicate. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg deals with this as well. Hang on one second. Deals with this as well in Source Yud Aleph. He's dealing with sleeping pills. And in a footnote on that, it's not his own footnote, somebody else put it into the edition that I have of the Tzitz Eliezer. You have the following quote from Rav David, based on Rav David Zvi Hoffman in Source Yud Aleph regarding sleeping pills. He says, I see no difference between sleeping pills and other types of medication. Sleeping pills calm the nerves when they are causing him pain, just as other painkillers will ease pain from other parts of the body. So wrote Rav David Zvi Hoffman, as cited here in the footnote on Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer. And it makes sense that you'll apply the same standard. If a person becomes bedridden due to his anxiety or due to his upset, then he would be allowed to take medication and prophylactically would be able to take medication to prevent that as well. Albert.
But that's not English.
Yeah?
That's called
No, there was an O. You see the O there? Dimkavli tu of a chalakagufa ideza O shenafala mishkav. It's either way, it is more than mechush. It's not mechush either way.
Right, it has to be.
No, that's true. Yes. Either way, it's more than mechush. I would distinguish it in chalakagufo in that. But that's true. In other words, there is a level of discomfort for which we say don't medicate a person on Shabbos. The mild headache, some kind of pain which you can live with and you can function with and it's just disturbing you. Okay, fine, so it's disturbing me. I'll wait till after Shabbos and I won't be disturbed by it. But anything that is deeper than that, it seems, does justify medication even on Shabbos. Is that component clear? Are we good so far? What we've done so far is present the terms, some of the terms that are used for anxiety and depression in the Gemara, and we talk about anxiety as a major concern for people who are already dangerously ill or in a dangerous situation, such that it would even warrant violating biblical law, and where a person has anxiety or depression that's severe enough that it would consign him to bed, then you could have him take medication, and you could also have him take medication to prevent such a situation. We equate the two, taking it when one is already in the situation and taking it prophylactically. Okay, that brings us to the next phase. Severe depression. Is that viewed as pikuach nefesh? There are two non-arguments that are sometimes presented against considering it pikuach nefesh. And I say non-arguments because they don't hold water, but they are mentioned. One is the fact that it's hard to diagnose a person's seriousness, meaning a person comes to the ER, a person comes to the doctor, whatever it is, and says that he's contemplating suicide. So does that mean that the person is actually in danger of committing suicide? Or is it a thought that doesn't have any depth to it? There is no plan associated with it. It's not that intense. But he's worried because he's never had these thoughts before and he doesn't know. Are we now going to treat this as a life and death situation? And some would argue that we don't. However, the general rule when you're dealing with pikuach nefesh, with life and death situations, is that suffering is considered like vadai. When you're in doubt, we consider it to be like something that's known and definite, meaning we err on the side of caution. When we have a patient who presents saying he's thinking about suicide, we don't stop and think, well, you know what, maybe he really couldn't carry it out. That's not a halachic argument. The other reason that some suggest to doubt that this is pikuach nefesh is because the patient is presenting me with a choice. Let's say it's not a matter of what he's going to do, but a matter of what I'm going to do. He says, listen, I have these thoughts, I'm in danger, you have to do something for me, and you need to be the one to violate Shabbos on his behalf. So then you could say, well, essentially he's telling me, if you don't violate Shabbos, then I'm going to kill myself. So, is that really a fair thing for him to do to me? But the answer is yes, because pikuach nefesh, saving a life, is not about whether his life would end by his own hand or by some other agency. Saving a life is saving a life. And therefore, that's also a non-argument. There is an interesting third possible argument. It's also not, it doesn't hold up, but here's the argument. The argument is that you could stop his condition. You could prevent him from harming himself by straitjacketing him. You have the possibility that you could remove from him his ability to harm himself. So why don't I say that you simply remove his ability and straitjacket him, and then he's no longer a danger to himself. He's no longer a danger to others. There are two reasons why that doesn't work. Number one, on a very practical level, is because people tend to find ways. The reality is that people find ways to harm themselves even after all the measures have been taken. That's number one. But number two, we generally, from a halachic perspective, don't require that sort of measure. That's not something that we generally would mandate. If you take a look on your sheet, source Yud Beis, as an example, Rabbi Chiyo Michal Epstein in his Aruch HaShulchan deals with the laws of Shabbos. Completely separate issue. Not what we're talking about right now. He points out that theoretically you could argue there's a rabbinic prohibition that's violated if a person walks in snow on Shabbos because he's crushing the snow and liquefying some of it. So you could argue that's rabbinically prohibited. Not biblical because it's not intentional, but it's rabbinically prohibited. So look at what he says. You have source your base. Va'afal pishalo yimaleit de derech derichaso nimas ma'at shaleg. He says, granted that it's inescapable that when you walk on snow, some snow will melt. Mikomakom still kaven dezeu derech yilucha lo shayach les or bazes. Since that's the way you walk, it's normal walking. It's not relevant to prohibit this. Vimke nias segurim bebatenu koy me'acharef. We'll end up being locked up in our houses all through the winter. Below Gazru, but that they didn't make any such decree. In other words, rabbinic law was not stated to cause a person to be locked up in his house the whole time. Even though there's a reasonable halachic argument to say you shouldn't be able to walk on snow, he says we don't do that. That we just don't do it. Ravadi Yosef in source Yud Gimel as a similar point regarding someone who is blind and treating blindness as a life and death situation, as pikuach nefesh, because he says a person who is blind could end up falling somewhere and getting hurt, and you can't tell me that he's expected to remain at home unless he has an escort. So he makes the same argument. It's not Rav Avadya's argument. He's making the argument from Rav Unterman. He actually argues with it on different grounds. But his point is that we don't consign people to situations in which they're going to have to live under very extreme conditions. So to hear, the solution for a person who's experiencing severe depression is not, so put him in a straitjacket and therefore he won't have to take pills on Shabbos. That's not what we do. It's not halacha.
He's talking about carrying a blind person carrying a stick.
He's not the stick case. He's dealing, if I remember correctly, with actually considering. I think he's actually considering it pikuach nefesh in terms of the need to heal him from being blind. Talking about when they have a surgery they can perform, something that they can do, and justifying overriding prohibitions in order to do it. The cane, in any case, probably would not be a problem because we talk about walking with support on Shabbos, and let's say someone needs crutches or whatever.
Depending on what the issue is exactly, what you're going to define, whether it's a d'oraisa or a d'rabbanan, would have an impact.
Correct.
Correct.
Right, so he's talking about the cure itself being something that would, yeah. So the overwhelming ruling of halachic authorities is that a person experiencing severe depression, whether because of threat to himself or threat to others, is considered to be in a pikuach nefesh situation. It is considered to be life and death, and we would be justified in doing whatever is necessary in order to remedy the situation. It's described in Rashi in source Yudalid. Yudalid is the Gemara. The Gemara is talking about convening gatherings to pray for people on Shabbos, fasting on Shabbos in order to save people. And one of the Gemara's cases is a person is experiencing ruach ra'a, and we want to hold a fast in order to pray for him, and it's Shabbos. You're not allowed to fast on Shabbos. This person is experiencing ruach ra'a, literally translates to an evil spirit. And Rashi explains, source Tezvav, Shenichnas bo ruach shida. Some kind of demon has entered him. The whole discussion about demonology classically is a great discussion that's way beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about right now. But he says, V'ratz v'holech, this person goes running around, V'shema yitba benar, or yipol v'yamas, and we're concerned he's going to drown himself in a river. We're concerned he's going to fall into a ditch and die. He is considered to be in a life-threatening situation such that it overrides Shabbos. If you take a look at source Tes Zion on the next page, and the Shulchan Aruch, or Chaim Reish Peches, says, Nirdaf mipnei ruach ra, sha'amru lav davka. Duhu adin l'chol chola sheyesh bo sakanas hayom, zoakin umischananin. He says, it's not just the person who is engaged in this ruach ra situation we just described, but anyone who is in danger that day. Within this situation. If you take a look at source Yudches, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram codifies this in his Nishmas Avram, source Yudches, he says, Choleh psychiatri kashe, someone who has a severe psychiatric illness, kegon hasovel midikaon amok, such as someone who is experiencing deep depression, v'yesh chashash she'alul l'sakenes atzmo oes acherim, such that we are concerned he might endanger himself or endanger others, mugdor kecholeh sheyesh bo sakana, he is defined as a patient who is dangerously ill, u'machal in olav es haShabbos l'fi hatzarech, and we would violate Shabbos for him as needed. That's the ruling of Avram Sofer Abraham. This extends beyond Shabbos. It comes up in Kashrus as well. You have somebody who needs to be committed, and the only asylum that's available, the only place, hospital, whatever, that's available is one in which he's not going to have kosher food. So do we admit him knowing that that's the case? So take a look at Source Yud Tes, Moshe Feinstein. Ruled this way. This actually was a tshuva he wrote to Rabbi Shochet in Toronto in 1965. He wrote, Ula yesh lidon mitzad mahalaso. Im yomer harofim sheyesh baze inyan pikuach nefesh. He says, perhaps we should view this based on his illness and say that if the doctors say that there is an issue of saving his life here, kigon de alul mizel laharoges atzmo bimiyelo ezet tsar, such as he might overreact to some pain and kill himself. Oh, diavar al dvarm sheasurim gam bedinei hamedina. Or he'll violate some law of the land, v'lo yishma lahap police. That's how Rav Moshe wrote police. The v'yariv imam ad sheyavo mizeh sheyarguhu. Or he might violate a law and he won't listen to the police and he'll fight with the police and they'll end up killing him in order to end the situation. Or perhaps the illness that he's suffering actually comes from something in his brain that requires treatment, that there's some kind of an issue there that's physically harming him. And you could only treat him in that place. Or Moshe on that basis is willing to justify committing him. I should note that Rav Moshe distinguishes between somebody who normally keeps kosher and someone who does not, for reasons that are beyond the scope of this year, but are fascinating. If you ask me at the end, afterwards, I'll tell you. Rav Moshe has a very interesting argument in that. But the point is, in terms of kashrus, again, he views severe depression as life and death. The issue comes up also in terms of birth control. If you take a look at source Chaf, this tshuva is on the case of a woman who experienced bad postpartum depression with her first two births, and and now the question is, will she be permitted to use contraception when she's with her husband? So he says, "Beisha shenishtades achar haleda b'shnei hayiladim sheolida." A woman gave birth to two kids, and each time she became a shota. That's the term he uses. She became irrational. V'arofim asru la lehis aber, and the physicians have now forbidden her from becoming pregnant. And yeshla atira l'shamish b'moch, would she be allowed to use contraception? And I left you the date in on the tshuva. This is written in 1961. He says to the person who asked him the question, you are undoubtedly correct that being in this state is a form of danger, not just for her, but also for her young children. Even if a person's irrationality does not normally lead him to be destructive, that can change. He says that suddenly she could make desire, she could well desire to harm herself or her kids. And it's not possible to set up guards that are going to watch her all the time to keep her from doing this. And therefore, he says he should indeed permit her to use contraception. He goes on to say, even physical barrier contraception, which normally we prohibit even more. Normally, when contraception is indicated, we generally say to use pills. But he's dealing with this in 1861, and he's concerned that the pills that they have at that point are not necessarily going to do what's needed, because it may lead to staining, and then she'll be anida, and then she won't be able to be with her husband, and that could exacerbate her condition, and therefore he ends up saying even barrier contraception would actually be acceptable. Rav Moshe also has another tshuva, which I brought a piece of here in Chaf Aleph, which actually was written to Rav David Ox. Is that Rav Mordechai Ox's father?
Yes.
So Rav David Ox in 1951. Regarding a couple who were supposed to get married, the deal is that if they don't get married, the problem essentially is that in order for her to get married to him, she would not be able to live with him without birth control. She's not able to become pregnant, and the concern is that on the one hand they shouldn't marry because then he won't be able to live with her normally as man and woman, and they'll have to use contraception. On the other hand, he says, maybe their situation is so dire let Rav Moshe speak for himself, because he actually walks you through it. Source Chaf Aleph. Im roa kavod taras harav shekol kach niskashu zelazeh ajiyesh chashash sakana leechad mehen. If you see that they are so enthralled with each other, they're so in love with each other, that it would actually be dangerous for one of them if you didn't let them marry. Ubifrat lefaneh shehi chola v'chalusha belozeh, and certainly for her, because she's already ill. The case was that she had some kind of a kidney ailment, and the doctor said that becoming pregnant would actually be hazardous for her. And because of the great pain, if she wouldn't marry him, and further, you can tell me she can't marry him. It's also a whole host of other men she can't marry because of this requirement that she not have children. It'll cause her to become still more ill. He says there is indeed room to permit for them the use of contraception, assuming they don't go telling other people about it. And the reason for that is that that we're concerned that people will extrapolate from this to their case, and maybe their case isn't as extreme. So that's an important qualifier that he presents. But my point in bringing this is that he's willing to consider her mental anguish as ample justification for the use of contraception. There are more like this. I brought you another couple of sources on it, but you get the picture. What about we've now defined severe depression as bikuach nefesh? What about preventing a person from entering the situation of severe depression? So the rule seems to be that we would consider a person justified in taking the medication prophylactically in order to keep up a level, in order to calm a specific situation, to prevent you from entering such a situation. I brought you in source Chaf Dalet, a source that we saw last year in one of our shiurim. We talked about treating wounds on Shabbos. So there, if you take a look at the Nishmas Avram, he quotes from Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Umuter Gam, yeah, I'll say it outside rather than get into it inside. He's talking about a catheter and the concern that a catheter might become infected. So he wants to wear some kind of a cover on the catheter. But he wants to walk around outside where there is no Eruv, and therefore we're not allowed to carry things on Shabbos. And his ruling is that you go out with the cover on the catheter. The reason being, you want to prevent infection, and that's considered to be a dangerous illness. The infection would be a dangerous illness. So in order to prevent a dangerous illness from developing, you are permitted to treat to prevent infection. That's the statement there. It comes up in other cases of wound treatment on Shabbos. And the same principle applies here, that we want to prevent the person from becoming dangerously ill from the depression. Therefore, you absolutely treat before the situation begins. I saw a great quote. If you take a look at source Chafei, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein quotes the Briska Rav, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. Amar Hagon, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, Harav mi Briska Larofei. The Briska Rav said to a doctor, Pikuach nefesh, saving a life, ein perusho sheka es yistakein v'yamuz. That doesn't mean that right now the person is in danger and is going to die. Ela af im haso miyashpia alav kavor shanim. He's talking about Yom Kippur. He says, even if the fast could affect him years later, the fact that he fasted today could affect him years later. Kasher yitkav shuv b'machala, when he is ill again. And because of the fast that he observed today, he'll end up dying early. That's pikuach nefesh. He is required to eat today. He says, pikuach nefesh doesn't mean I save you when you're falling off a cliff. Pikuach nefesh means I keep you from the cliff in the first place. That's that's the principle set down by the Briska Rav. And that seems to be the way that we paskin. If you take a look on source Chavav on the last side, Rav Yudah Leib Graubart in the Tshuvos Chavalim Bani Imim talks about this as well, and he deals with the case of somebody who was psychotic and is in danger of being so again. Now, he actually clarifies and qualifies and says that's specifically because the patient was ill once before, and therefore we believe the person to be vulnerable. In other words, preventing a person from becoming ill, because we say, well, being in this situation could ultimately result in, is not sufficient. There has to be a reason to suspect vulnerability. Whether that's because the person was ill once before with this, or their person is under some other compromising condition, like the woman who was the oledes, who was giving birth, you need to have some sense that the person actually is vulnerable. We require some evidence of the danger. This comes up in particular in discussions about abortion, where a woman is pregnant And the sense of the physicians is that there is reason to think that she might suffer extreme anxiety and depression as a result of carrying the fetus to term. It comes up in the rape and incest cases. It comes up also sometimes if she's carrying a fetus, and the physicians believe that based on ultrasound or tests that the fetus is not viable. So on that basis, the argument is made, well, we should abort. So Rav Shlomo Wasner and his Shevet Halevi in Source Chav Zayin is very concerned that that we might diagnose this inappropriately, that we might decide this even cases where it's not warranted. And in fact, there's an article from 1981 that was published in the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association, Psychiatric Aspects of Therapeutic Abortion, in which the argument was made that a great number of therapeutic abortions performed in Canada at the time were performed for psychological reasons but without consultation of a mental health professional. And the numbers they presented were staggering. It was something like 85% of therapeutic abortions were performed for the sake of mental health, and in only 10% of cases was a mental health professional actually consulted.
Just a historical footnote. At
yes.
At that time, I believe the abortion laws had been liberalized to... we are now version of abortion on demand, but back then it was the medical reason. So they had abortion committees at the hospitals, and they were all rubber stamped that said, okay, depression, what's next?
And that would be why you had such a high percentage that were getting called that. Interesting. I did look around. I found some articles on the hospital therapeutic abortion committees nowadays and how they function, and the general Canadian guidelines for inducing abortion. If people are curious, I can give you some web links for it. But the concern is a valid one. In other words, this is a very slippery slope. How exactly do I diagnose this? Is very tricky. So what we've said on this issue of severe depression is, number one, it qualifies as pikuach nefesh, and number two, preventing it qualifies as pikuach nefesh as well. Last point, the most interesting from an academic perspective, is a suicidally depressed person considered a shota? The reason why this is such an interesting topic is because if he is a shota, that means he's exempt from all mitzvos automatically. That's it, across the board. It also creates serious complications, though. I am a Mesader Kiddushin, right? I'm the rabbi officiating at a wedding, and two witnesses are brought up to me that they're going to be the ones who are going to testify about the Kiddushin. So normally I have to ask them, are you observant of Torah and Mitzvot? Are you related to each other? Now I would have to ask, are you being treated for severe depression? If you're going to tell me that someone who's being treated for it is a shota. It creates certain complications. In practice, I'm going to, since I know some people are going to have to leave a little early, I'll tell you that we don't consider the person a shota, but let's walk through the sources a little bit. We saw already the Gemara in Chagiga that defined a shota with those three behaviors and said, well, either it's all three behaviors or it's only one of those behaviors. So take a look at source Chaf Ches, please. Rabbi Yosef Karo explains how we approach this debate about whether you have to engage in all three, whether you only have to engage in one. How is a person determined to be a shota, determined to be mentally incompetent? Upasak harash, he says, the rush, quote, the rush rule, Rabbeinu Asher, Bereish Chulin, the Gemara in the beginning of Chulin Kerabi Yochanan. He followed the view of Rabbi Yochanan. If you don't remember what Rabbi Yochanan said, take a look back at Source Dalet. Rabbi Yochanan said a person is a shota even if they do one of the three things. They walk around alone at night, they tear their clothing, the sleeping in the cemetery, how could I forget? So the Rosh follows Rabbi Yochanan, any one of those is sufficient to render a person a shota. V'tanya tu bereish Chagiga, we have a brisa in the beginning of Chagiga, that's when we read, Ezu shota, this actually we did not read, I'm sorry, gives a fourth view. It says, or a fourth symptom, who is a shota? Zehama abed komasha nosnilo, someone who thing you give him. V'chei nira midivrei harambam, and so it appears from the Rambam, da'alacha k'Rabbi Yochanan, that the law follows Rabbi Yochanan, any one of these symptoms renders a person a shota. Shekasa peretes mehilchos edus halacha tes, ha-shota pasul edus min ha-tara l'fisheinu ben mitzvos. The Rambam wrote that a shota is not able to testify in court biblically because he is not obligated in mitzvos. V'lo shota shu mahalich arum m'shavar kelim v'zorek avon and bilvad, not not only a shota who walks around without clothing on, or breaks things, or throws stones, but anybody whose mind is confused. There's that term we used in the beginning in the Gemara Nida. I told you we're going to come back to that term. Nitrafadaito, the person experiences a torn mind, literally. Vinimsa daito mishubeshas tamid bedarim in advarim. His mind is confused constantly in some issue. Ava pishu medaber v'shawa ke'inyin b'sh'ar devarim. Even if on all matters other than the one on which he is irrational, he speaks, he asks questions, just like anybody else does. Hareza pasul, he is disqualified as a witness. Ubechlal shotim yechashev, and he is considered a shota. From the fact that the Rambam said a person who presents as a shota in some matter, mashma behedyut dek Rabbi Yochanan, it sounds clearly like he follows Rabbi Yochanan. Damra afilu ba'achas mehen svirolei, who says that the person is a shota even if he's a shota in just one matter, even in just one of those symptoms. That's his argument. That's the Rambam's position. There are others who disagree, but that's the position of the Rambam. So would I argue, in fact, that a person who is undergoing severe depression is perhaps a shota? So the Gemara seems to say no. The Gemara seems to say that anxiety is not considered to be irrational. Just like we said, the person who sleeps in the cemetery and wants to do something that we consider bizarre, but he has a thought process that takes him there, is not a shota. So too, the person who even wants to end his life is not considered to be a shota. Remember I mentioned to you in the beginning this Gandripus case, right? We said the person might wander around the streets alone at night because of Gandripus. Take a look at Source Chavtes. Rashi explains what Gandripus is. La'olam deka'avelu derech shtus. We're talking about where he engages in these things in the act, in a manner of shtus. Va'afilu hachi lo mechazkinan le'bachada. And yet we will not assume him to be a shota just for having one of the symptoms. Da'ayotze yechidi balayla emor Gandripus achte. He's quoting from the Gemara. The person who walks around alone at night may be gripped by Gandripus. Ani shamati. Rashi says, I have heard. Choli ha'ochez mitoch da'aga. He has some kind of illness that besets him because he's worried. He is anxious. Having a feeling of anxiety is sufficient for us to say, okay, the person is not a shota. He is simply he's simply trying to get out. He needs to get away from people, and he's not a shota. He's not considered to be irrational. That seems to be the position that the Gemara takes. It's the view taken by many authorities. The Chasam Sofer dealt with it in Source Lamed, in which he talked about the case of a man who becomes enraged on a daily basis. Just out there rages that he can't control. And the Chasam Sofer, on the rush, which is quoted in the tour, says, such a man, when he's not in the actual fit of rage, if we can convince him to divorce his wife, then he can divorce her. Even though a shota, someone who's irrational, is not halachically eligible to divorce, this man is considered to be eligible to divorce. Why? Because he's not irrational. He's just angry. Anger, as bad as it is, does not condemn him to be considered irrational. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Michael Epstein, in Source Lamed Aleph, said the same thing. He said somebody who is very sad, someone who can't get energy up because he's depressed, does not mean that he actually qualifies as irrational. Sorry? Does not qualify as irrational. There are two considerations, though, that I should mention. One is from the Stechemet. The Stechemet points out, or Chizkiya Medini points out, that a state of depression can lead to bilbul moach, can lead to the mind becoming confused. We shouldn't just say, well, he's depressed, therefore he's not irrational. Depression can, in fact, lead a person to an irrational state. That's number one. Number two, interesting position, in Source Lamed Beis, the last source, in the Otzar HaPoskim, which was headed by Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, although he didn't write all the tshuvos that are quoted in it, talks about a case in which a man's wife develops Mara Shechora, this black bile condition, this condition of depression, and says there that because a person in this state becomes destructive, wants to destroy yourself, wants to destroy property, maybe we really should consider it to be a shota because she is self-destructive. That's the that's his position. As a general rule, we don't say this. We assume that even though one is destructive, if the destruction has a specific goal, there's a thought process in mind, then that person is not considered to be a shota. So to return to our initial vignettes, the case of Joshua, the 45-year-old man, and we want to have him take medication on Shabbos based on the Tzitz Eliezer. The answer is absolutely. The Tzitz Eliezer said that was the one who said that anxiety in and of itself is considered to be a significant condition. And he would be able to continue it. Also note that Rav Moshe Feinstein had said that mental illness can take unpredictable turns, and that's always something to keep in mind. So we would have the person take the anti-anxiety medication, the antipsychotics, whatever, depending on what he has. On Shabbos. The case of the woman who, Leah, the 25-year-old mother of two children, experienced heavy postpartum depression after both births, so would she be able to use an IUD? So there are complications here that would require extra consideration. Has the husband fulfilled pre-revu before? Has he procreated yet? How long would she need it in? That sort of thing. But Rav Moshe was really rather clear in expressing his permission in this case. The third case, Jason displays symptoms of depression, has spoken, albeit vaguely, of suicidal thoughts. We can only commit him to a place where they're not going to keep Shabbat and kosher food is unavailable. So what do we do? So Rav Moshe says, yes, you can commit him, with the caveat again that I'm willing to revisit afterwards with people about if he doesn't normally keep kosher, maybe I wouldn't be able to commit him. But the rule would seem to be that yes, we would be able to commit him if that's all that's available. Sorry? If he does, correct. It's a very interesting argument. I'll do it after if people want to stick around, but we're already hitting the hour mark in all of 7 seconds. The case of Lauren, who is manifesting signs of serious depression, including loss of appetite, lack of care for her person, loss of a feeling of self-worth, but she refuses treatment. Should we treat her against her will? So we go back with this to the classes that we had on treating a patient against his will and the issue of consent. And we said, based on Rav Yaakov Emden in his Moruk Tzia, that where treatment is not invasive, and it's the clear medical consensus, and it's pikuach nefesh, then we absolutely do it even against the patient's will. And so we would do the same in this case. Finally, Julia is 17 and has attempted suicide with overdoses of medicine before. We would like to treat with SSRIs in order to lower the risk of overdose, but we know that some studies have shown increased suicidal ideation in young patients, while others have not. And I saw literature back and forth, both sides of the issue. I'm not going to handle whether one is right in this point. My point is only that I have a medication I'd like to use to treat, but there are potential negative side effects, serious side effects. Do I go ahead with this treatment? So this goes back to our discussion that we had last year about the double effect, treatments which help and also harm. And we said there that if this is the medical consensus, then we do it even knowing that there is a risk. That's the point of rapo yirape. When the Gemara says the physician is given permission to heal, it doesn't mean you're given permission to heal when the treatment is obvious and there are no negative things. Of course you're obligated to heal in such a situation. The point is that you're permitted to heal even knowing that there's a potential downside to it. If that's the consensus, that this is the way to treat, then this is indeed the way to treat. And so that's what we would do. I'm sorry that I ended up talking so much. We usually try to have a lot more questions in the middle. There was so much here, and I added a bunch last night from questions I got from people over Shabbos, but please, open to the floor. Yes? Oh, it can't be that clear cut.
Can you tell us about the kosher?
All right, so I'll do that at the end. Yes?
I just had a question. The case that you gave, the first one again, it seems like this Joshua is just in the beginning of treatment.
Yes.
So instead, according to what probably is permitted because that's okay. But the person is stable on the medication. They've been on antidepressants for 6 months, they're stable.
Right.
But there's a question that 24 hours is not likely that by missing a dose or delaying a dose, they're going to.
Right.
Get sick again, so, right. It might, you know, so what about that?
Right, this was actually, this is very interesting. This was one of the questions that I was given, that someone asked me about the sources that I had sent out, about the vignettes that I had sent out, because I was actually working from a case that I was involved with a young man who was experiencing racing thoughts and hypomanic state veering into manic, and was taking something and was told by the physician he couldn't fast on Yom Kippur, even though he had been taking the medication for a while. Now, I don't remember now all the ins and outs and complications that were involved in the case to remember why the physician said that, but I was told in an email that this is not a concern, that you can actually skip for 24 hours because it works based on a built-up level within the bloodstream. So if that's really so, that skipping it for 24 hours is not going to affect the patient and the patient will be okay, then that's what I would say to do. Or you know what, it wasn't a skipping case, it was a taking it with food case. That was the discussion there. But in any case, if he can manage to skip it, then let him skip it, you know, or let him time it, take a Friday earlier, Matzai Shabbos late. I mean, I'll tell you, I did look up online the materials on various antipsychotics, and it seems like all of them give you the same basic advice if you miss a dose. They all say, take it if it's soon after, but otherwise don't take an additional one, just wait for your next dose. And they don't say report to your emergency room, you know, call your psychiatrist or psychologist. They don't say that. So it seems like the patient should really be able to skip once he's built up a proper dose. But each case is going to be specific and kefiro sene hadayon according to what the physician sees for that case. Other questions, or I'll go into the motion quickly. Oh yeah. Once you get into other realms of medicine, you know, you certainly do find such things. Sure. Yes. Please make sure to fill out evaluations if you have to leave.
Yeah. They want to go a little bit stronger, like the kids just saying, they used to ask, like, are you committed to do things? So we go in an opposite of that situation where the halakha says you actually must do, you must take that pill.
Right. That's a really good question. The answer is yes. The way the halachic imperatives work is very often that they're binary. Either this is asur, it's prohibited, or it's chayim, you're obligated to do it. Classic example, lashon hara. Lashon hara ordinarily is prohibited, right? You're not allowed to speak harmfully about others. However, when we talk about lashon hara that's permitted, it's actually obligatory. So, for example, someone is about to hire a person, and I know that that person is an embezzler. And the person who's going to be his employer doesn't know that. So I'm not just permitted to tell him, I'm obligated to tell him. Same thing may well apply here. In the case in which the patient is bedridden through Shabbos, that's actually destroying the patient's own egg Shabbos, the enjoyment of Shabbos, which is an obligation. I am obligated to enjoy Shabbos. So then that patient is actually obligated to take his medicine in order to be to restore him. So yes, the word permitted is maybe misleading. If the patient really is going to be bedridden without it, he's obligated to take the medication. Good point. Thank you. Other questions? So briefly, what Rav Moshe said is that what Rav Moshe said was that the heterim for pikuach nefesh, where we allow a person to violate halacha in order to save his life, don't necessarily apply in a case where a person also enjoys doing the violation of halacha, where a person enjoys it. So he talks about a person who. It's a long story, but basically a person who is compelled to engage in illicit relations to save his life, or a woman who's compelled to, in a case in which she doesn't have a choice, isn't able to, it's a longer discussion. And basically he says that if a person would actually enjoy it, engaging in that activity, then it wouldn't be justified even to save his life. So therefore he says, if you have somebody who normally eats non-kosher and is going to happily eat the non-kosher in the hospital, then you can't justify it as pikuach nefesh. You can't justify it as saving his life, and the person who in fact puts him there, who commits him, is violating lifnei iver, putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. It's a very interesting argument. I didn't get a chance to research it and see if anybody else actually takes this up as Rav Moshe does, but it's a very interesting discussion. Yes?
I think a problem with that morally and ethically, and yeah. Also as a physician, if I deliberately do not admit somebody who might be suicidal because they might enjoy eating kosher food, and then they did go out and kill themselves,
Yes. I'm 100% agree. This is a very hard thing, and I want to really research it. That's why I waited till the end of it. I didn't want to bring it up in the middle of this year. It's something that requires a lot more research in terms of what Rav Moshe meant to say and how it would apply and how other posts can rule. I'm definitely not recommending carte blanche. You know, go ahead. This is what you should do. If you have a patient who's Jewish and generally doesn't keep kosher, don't commit him. Also, from what I understand, it's generally possible to get kosher food at this point. I don't know about Toronto. I know with places where I've lived, it's been possible to get kosher food when one was committed. So it's not as though this is the reigning condition today. But you had a question?
I was kind of extended into the issue of dementia and drugs for that, but that's not the topic.
Yeah, and I'm not ready to address it.
Assuming that depression is chronic and untreatable, and you can't revert back to a normal baseline, do you have an evidence principle still applying?
Chronic, non-treatable,
and you can't go back to your baseline.
So in other words, what we're doing is basically keeping him from getting worse.
In other words, does the principle that the doctor used mean that to be conditioned that it has to be that you can come back to a state where you are normal?
Right.
And if that's the case, then maybe the principle would not apply. You would not be...
Right. But I think that even if normal is to be out of a pikuach nefesh situation, in other words, what we're trying to do is to prevent the person from having a severe bout, and we won't be able to relieve the fact that he has mild depression. I think that's sufficient already, because normal may mean ending the pikuach nefesh situation. Normal may not mean able to walk around as other people are. I suspect that that's true. Yes?
Can you extrapolate the information? So, for example, we're talking about finding somebody to prevent for migraine medications.
So I think that's actually a case that's often cited on this, and I think that generally speaking it is applied to migraine medications. I mean, I've even heard that quoted as the paradigm of consigned to bed is the migraine headache, because it fits the general description very well. So generally I would say, again, for all practical matters, ask the shul rabbi, but that's my general approach. Yes?
Just a comment about, if you're in a steady state and about using medication on Shabbos, and even though the CPS may say if you miss a dose, don't take double, there is also the concern about, yes, you're in a steady state, but if you typically don't take your medication on Shabbos, there is the possibility that your level goes down. Yes, you bring it up, and maybe that day you're not going to be in trouble, but you might actually manifest symptoms the next day or the day after.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Similarly with the birth control pill, if you don't take it on a regular basis, some pills are so sensitive that you could get pregnant, but not necessarily that day, but several days down the road, because your level has dipped. You ovulate, and even though you've taken it for 24 hours later and your levels are coming up, it's already too late.
Right, and that's why I stress that it's really dependent on the situation. I mean, for the case that I'm remembering that I was involved with, there were quite a few factors that I think could have complicated it. There was OCD involved, and therefore a concern that maybe he needs the routine. There was an issue also. There, the discussion was taking it with food, and the issue was stomach reaction if he wouldn't have it with food, and whether he would not take it in the future. There are all sorts of complicating factors when you're talking about missing a dose, and definitely rabbi-physician cooperation to figure out whether it's really appropriate for that situation is a must. It's not something I would say as a definite across the board. Oh well, if the medication indicates, if the literature says, skipping a dose isn't a problem, that doesn't mean skip a dose. As they always say, going off of medication requires consultation with a physician, and that's true even skipping a dose. It's not just this. Thank you very much. I think our next session is February 20th.